Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the people, the clinicians, the founders, the CEOs, the leaders, the journalists that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech venture myself, which is called PocDoc. PocDoc's Healthy Heart Check is now the number one tool being used in the UK outside of a GP surgery to screen for cardiovascular risk and deliver cholesterol results in homes, communities, and workplaces across the country. You can find it in any pharmacy, pretty much, or you can head to our website, which is pocdoc.co, P-O-C-D-O-C.co. So thank you so much to everyone who's listening live on UK Health Radio. We love UK Health Radio. We love having the live platform. And thank you also if you are listening on any of our podcast channels. We're available across all of them. We love all the downloads. We get downloads from people now in over 50 countries every single month. So thank you so much for that. It's an incredible statistic that we love to repeat. Thank you if you are watching this on my Instagram channel, which is at Steve Roost, or if you are watching this on our Health Tech Hour YouTube channel. So hi, I'm waving, but you can only see that if you're watching as opposed to listening. So on to today's show. On today's show, we've got someone that I know really well from being a health tech founder. She is one of the leading voices, most trusted voices in UK health tech. I'd like to introduce you to Rachel Murphy. So Rachel launched the NHS app, if we remember back before a time when an NHS app existed, which is hard for a lot of us. But Rachel actually launched the NHS app. She has built, scaled and sold multiple businesses in healthcare and not in healthcare, and now has founded and runs an organization called The Grafter, which is focused on helping founders grow, scale, and then exit their businesses successfully. She's also been really public about very personal things, such as her journey through recovery, through alcohol addiction, and her public statements and sharing about that is extremely inspirational and might be something that we get into. So, Rachel, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, Steve. Absolutely delighted to be here. And I'm brilliant. The sun is shining. It's a marginal rarity, so we'll take it.
So I want to take you back to begin with to the time before the NHS app existed. What on earth, how on earth did you get involved in that project? And like, I'd love to get any insight that you're willing to share about like the conversations that were happening at that point, like, should we have an app? What should the app do? You know, like, could you just give us a bit of insight? Because I just think it's such an incredible story.
Yeah, very happy to. So prior to working for the NHS, I was doing a business transformation for the health regulator, Nursing and Midwifery Council, and we were launching things like revalidation and bringing digital components to market, really. And for me, I totally fell in love with healthcare, and I felt really strongly that I didn't want to go and do another role for a private sector business. And I ended up having a conversation about building NHS.UK. So that was how the conversation started. And at that time, it was all about NHS choices. So massive repository of flat file content that, if I'm right in remembering, was probably written for degree age people who were wanting to mainly look at data and information relating to their kids. And so the challenge that I was given was, we've got to reduce footfall into A&E, and that really was the original ask.
And at
And
what and wh who in the wonderful wide world of the NHS universe made said request? Like, who came up with this?
at that time, the well, there's a funny story around this, so I'll tell you all of it. So at that time, the role was NHS.UK. The early conversations around this role and what we were doing were into Rob Shaw, who was the I think interim chief exec at the time, and James Hawkins. I can't actually remember James's role, if I'm honest, but he was on the board of NHS Digital, and the ask was, we've got to start reducing the footfall into A&E. And Juliet Bower had been recently appointed into NHS England, and Juliet's remit was, as the commissioner, to reduce that footfall. So we were the delivery partner, really. The ask initially was, can we do something with choices, which was very much described as a national asset, and they were so fearful of reducing traffic on that website. When we first started talking about this and explaining, we're going to be launching live digital services, and it's going to be fundamentally different. It's not just a website, supported by 120 journalists sharing content. This is actually going to fundamentally, become the digital front door for the
But
NHS.
how, okay, so this, I love, this is why I love doing the show. So, and because I love digging into these
Yeah,
stories,
of
because
course,
like
far away.
you've kind of, you've very eloquently like compressed what I'm sure was quite a number of meetings and arguments and conflict and disagreements and stuff into a very eloquent sort of if then type statement. So, at what point did it become obvious to people that what was needed was not just a slightly better version of NHS Choices, but a fundamentally, as you said, like, NHS app? Because right now, today, where we see it, everyone's like, oh yeah, NHS app, front door of care. Oh yeah, let's launch a, everyone's like, oh yeah, of
Yeah,
course, right? Like,
that so wasn't the case, mate. So
right.
if we go back, the initial conversation was, how are we moving from one website to another? That's where it started, and
Right.
it was all about having it as proprietary software. It was not about exploring open source. It was not about digital services. There had been 10 or 11 boards set up, and each project had a board sitting around it. There was over 100 people who were
Wow.
managing from a senior stakeholder perspective,
Oh my
the
God.
patient-facing initiatives. And one of the very first things we did was disband all of them, which went down like a cold cup of sick.
They love that. They love getting disbanded.
They absolutely hated us. But what we knew was that we wanted to run the kind of domain name. If we were part of a paperless 2020 agenda, and we really wanted a kind of youthful board of a dozen people across the system who we could actually take on this journey, who we could show what we were building. Instead of showing, rolling in with a load of reams of paper and kind of old school reporting. So we disbanded the boards, that kicked off. And then we made a move to establish one board with 12 or 13 people. And it was about getting buy-in. So Matthew Swindells was Chief Operating Officer. Matthew was on the board. And it was very much around, we've got a lot of opportunities here. This is in a period of time where government digital services have been running, a very different way of approaching the build of digital services. And we were absolutely wanting to follow suit. We didn't want to buy another massive website, with third-party suppliers. It was all about, let's do the user research. Let's actually understand what the public want from these services. And that really is where we started. But it started dramatically with disbanding the boards. And then we went through varying stages to get buy-in that this wasn't a new website. It was all about understanding the user needs. And it was then about actually building services that would add value. So instead of it being flat file, it was starting to tease out, transactional services. And that was a massive shift. So the fight we had around, moving away from proprietary software and then needing to hire in skills that we didn't have hanging around, we ended up building, a very multidisciplinary team. So we had clinicians, we had social workers, we had emergency care surgeons as part of the team, not because we wanted to tool around and build a massive team, but because we had to really understand the needs across the piece. But the last thing we wanted to do was build, have digital people build a digital service without the patient needs and the clinician needs represented.
Yeah, and I think those last two things, patient needs, clinician needs, I feel like sometimes get completely forgotten by people, and build things just get built and money gets spent, and no one's really built it up from first principles around, user requirements, customer requirements, etc.
It was intense, the user need piece, but also starting to look at this in a very different way. This was right at the early stages, even down to where we were working and how we were working. It was a very digital setup, from a kind of Kanban, Scrum ban, bringing new thinking and new skills into Wellington House. And it was very much an educate, get buy-in. And of course, the reality was, we had to get buy-in for a service that did not exist. So we had to design something that, people had not seen before and had not bought into. So
And at what point does the COVID meteor strike happen in this story?
a lot further down the road. So this was probably 3 or 4 years before. So we started that process a number of years before. And things like register with a GP was one of the first services we built and we actually released on NHS.uk. But it then ended up getting disbanded. And over time, a number of those other services have been built. But the real momentum around this, was at the point of COVID, the use went through the roof in way of the app. I mean, it would obviously, but if I just paint a little picture on that journey, NHS.uk, the front door, the NHS app came later, and there was a whole raft of other initiatives around citizen identity, putting Wi-Fi into hospitals, widening digital participation. So lots and lots of different projects that rolled up into that program, but I think prior to COVID, uptake would have been 4 or 5 million users. But at the
Right.
point, you're reliant upon that for getting out and about, the adoption went through the roof, and that
Yeah.
therefore has fast become the digital front door we see today.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. I love going back. I mean, basically, you've got, what have they got now? Like nearly 80%? Is it that? How high is it? No. Is it,
It's
what have they got?
I think it's 45 million.
Yeah, it's a
You've got
lot.
a hefty amount of people, but also every conceivable age range. And
Yeah.
I remember some of the dissenters at the beginning saying 70-year-old people, the old silver tsunami, they're never going to use it. And I can tell you, they absolutely do.
Yeah, also, like, I think people view things in a static way. So, like, a lot of that, and we had it, a popped up. I mean, any digital innovator, I think, has probably heard the same story around, like, older people won't do this. It doesn't matter what it is, if it just involves a phone. And, like, the truth is, older people are getting a lot younger, if that makes sense, right? So, they're, I mean, they all use phones all the time. Now, are they as, they're probably not on Snapchat necessarily, although some of them might be, but they're pretty capable. So, and also, I thought it was interesting. I don't know if you remember this time, but there was a period of time where something called the MyGP app. Do you remember the MyGP app, right? Which was this, and like there was this weird time where the NHS app was sort of lagging behind this MyGP app, which was owned by, who was it? I can't remember the name of the company, but they kind of were like in and around GP services, and that had like 20 million, and the NHS app was trying to get ahead of it. Do you remember that period of time? It's kind of weird.
It's and I guess there was a bit of history as well, because by the time I jumped in to lead this program of work, I think they'd already attempted one apps library as well. And
Oh
so there was
yeah.
the infamous, we can't do this again. The last time was a bit of a shit show. And so, but there was a, as there often is when you're driving change, you've got the kind of, we've been here, it didn't work last time. So there was a fair bit of noise around that. But to be honest, for me, that adoption elsewhere is, if ever you were looking for evidence that it's coming, it's like it is literally racing
Yeah.
alongside you. So you've got to got to get on board. I remember some of the early discussions where we're kind of punting this visual proposition around what we're actually going to do. And at that time, everyone already had an online bank account.
Right.
Everyone was booking their holidays online. And we couldn't do a bloody thing accessing our health data or
Right.
booking appointments or registering with GPs.
Yeah.
So, we felt strongly that it was needed.
And how, what is it about your mentality, do you think, or your approach to problem solving, or, that meant that you were particularly well suited for that environment? Because it, based on my experience, not exactly the same thing, clearly, but similar environments, you have to be, on the one hand, a consensus builder, but on the other hand, very directive and stubborn and willing to have conflict, as well as highly detailed orientated, as well as able to see the bigger picture. It's a very tricky environment to work within and be successful in.
So I think the point I always stress here was there was a team. It's never just one individual. I was very lucky that the commissioner from the NHS England side had come from the private sector as well, but also was no nonsense. And at even at early stages of meeting, we absolutely knew that we both had a boatload of energy and that we would be making this happen. We were very aligned around that kind of vision. But I think dogged determination and relentlessness is, if being totally frank, that for me was the kind of key attribute needed to drive the change. The NHS always amuses me, because once you start driving a change, you don't have to get some rocks thrown at you. It's not like everyone's sitting there rejoicing, saying
No.
hallelujah. It's like, right, okay, they're ahead now of where we are, so
Yeah.
let's try and throw some curveballs, which I will always find astonishing.
Yeah, I do. I look, anyone that is trying to change anything about the healthcare system has experienced exactly what you're talking about. And I think that there's multiple different reasons for that. And I think the fact that you can take it with a pinch of salt and a smile probably speaks to why you were successful in that. Because I do know that some people get very, very, very personally emotional about when that happens, as opposed to kind of expecting it to happen. It happens, dealing with it, you know. I've seen people take that really deeply.
Yeah, I think my kind of background prior to the NHS, I've worked in a lot of dysfunctional places, and for me, not taking it personally, but also there is a, being honest, there's a big part around impact. I'm heavily driven by that. If I look back on my career and think about the truly useful things that I've done, that gig will remain, probably the most useful I ever do. And so there's something about that wanting to kind of give back, and being very proud of what we achieved, kind of against all the odds in some regards.
I think it's a fantastic story. Right, we have to go for our first commercial break now, and then we'll be back in 2 minutes with my amazing guest today, Rachel Murphy, who's the CEO and founder of The Grafter. And after the break, we're going to jump into your stories around building businesses, scaling businesses, selling businesses, which then leads on to, I think, the reason why you went out and did The Grafter or are doing The Grafter. So we'll be back in 2 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Rachel Murphy from The Grafter. So, Rachel, what was your journey like into being a founder, an entrepreneur, building your own businesses? What was that journey like? And then I know that particularly your most recent exit was very formative in then influencing what you've now gone on to do with The Grafter.
So my background really around building businesses, I built the first one in my 20s, definitely more luck than judgment. That happened to be in social care. So there's a theme emerging here around the kind of loving healthcare. And then I decided to go back and get some actual experience running a consultancy, and ended up working for a number of the Big Four, lots of private sector organizations, and perhaps most importantly, led a number of turnaround and transformations, public and private. So for me, I guess I've taken some of that learning from larger businesses. And I knew after I finished the NHS gig that I wasn't bowled over by any of the agencies saying that they really understood healthcare and that they cared deeply from a user-centered perspective. And I felt I could build something that would compete. And that was what I did with my last business with Different. And we ended up building national services. We built the UK's COVID home testing service. We built NHS jobs. We built loads of national services for government and healthcare. And I guess for me, the second time round, I knew I wanted to go in and out in a 5-year period. And I had something to prove. And I think that's what really drove and motivated me. And I absolutely loved it. It was great fun. It was crazy. I think if I'd known that that was a dangerously short period of time, if I, you know what it's like, you know, the more information you've got, sometimes it's not necessarily good. So I was a bit naive, and I thought I can be in and out in 5 years, and that's exactly what happened, and it was great fun.
What was it about the other agencies that made you think you could outcompete them?
I thought it that their offer was very thin on being real domain experts in healthcare. So I just thought I've seen the same stuff across government as I've seen across healthcare, and I'm not seeing things that we did in building the NHS app or NHS.UK, the multidisciplinary teams, you know, having clinicians as part of the team, and making it real. I saw tons of digital people who had gone on the journey from technology to digital, but I didn't see, well, where are the patients? I didn't see where are the clinicians? And
Interesting.
that for me was the bit that I thought, I think we can do this better. But I really wanted it coming from a user-centered design perspective. I didn't want to be digital building, digital services. And so that was my kind of,
But
that was my motivation.
what I find crazy is that that was, and it clearly was, because it clearly worked, enough of a differentiator. Because on the face of it, I'm not trying to be harsh or anything, but like that user-centered design and integrated clinicians and patients and things like
Yeah.
that I'm shocked that that was such a leap, if that makes sense. Put it that way.
But if we, I sold that business back in 2020, so we're talking 5 years before then. So it wasn't, you know, tech for good was only just getting banded around. It wasn't, these things were not embraced in the same way, not at all across government healthcare at that time. I mean, don't get me wrong, we were really good at what we were doing as well.
Obviously.
But equally, it was there's always luck with these things, Steve. Anyone who says, you know, I'm an absolute genius, it's like, pull the other one. You know, we got lucky. I
Timing.
had a good track record of delivery within the NHS. And I think we worked bloody hard. You know, we won our first outcome, 154 grand. For a 14 weeks worth of work, and that became £10 million contract over 3 years. But it was because we really went over and above. And I think that kind of ethos of what we built and delivered meant that we became synonymous with delivery in healthcare much faster than perhaps we should have been. I mean, there are hundreds of these agencies now, but there was not at that time, you know, nowhere
Interesting.
near as many.
And Joe, do you feel like you paved the way for other people? Or like was that explosion always going to happen? I guess COVID must have driven a lot of
I
that as
think it
well.
was probably always going to happen. But I think if I think about our competition when we first started out, we were competing against Big Four on deals. The very first deal we went after, we didn't win it, but we were up against Accenture. We actually won on points, but we didn't get awarded it because we weren't Accenture. So it's, you know, I mean, they didn't say that to me. Many years later, the procurement person did. But I think the kind of uniqueness of user-centered design at that point with true healthcare delivery expertise. A lot of people talk again about how much actual delivery they've done in healthcare, but to your earlier point, you know, it is a bloody nightmare getting stuff done in healthcare working for the NHS. So there is only really, you know, a handful's probably, you know, being too over the top. But we're not awash with people who've actually delivered in the system, would be my summary.
That's really interesting. And so you have, I know that You've said this already, and I know in the materials around the grafter and everything that you communicate online, you're very clear that you have this 5 year in and out vision. That's true, right? You were locked in on that.
Yeah, totally. And it was crystal, like right from the even week one of building different, we were, penning the strategy and we were building our plan. And 18 months in, we had a sell pack and we were talking to the market. So it was really, really nailed on.
And how do you, or how did you navigate this sort of thing where it's better to not be for sale if you want to sell, sort of with, sort of dating type of analogy?
We built a great rep really quick. We built a brand that people perceived was larger than it was. And I think the other bit is we partnered really well. We collaborated brilliantly. And this is something that people, it always surprises me. It's like the chances are one of your competitors is going to buy you. So here's the news. Working with them might not be a bad idea. But and we were very good and very intentional about working with other companies. And I think if I was to look back, that would be heavily linked to us thinking a potential sale would come that way. And that helped. So you're right, you don't want to be going out to market with a big sign around you. We were approached, we already had a sell pack in play, but we were approached before we were ready to move on doing a deal. So we were approached in the November of 25, sorry, November of 19. And we didn't do a deal until nearly 12 months later. But that first approach, and then we were into COVID and we were working very closely with some of those other companies, but we were also working with the CEOs of those companies. So the kind of top-to-top exposure meant that as individuals, we were working together and we wouldn't normally have been. So we formed fast relationships. And so it therefore meant those conversations happened faster, perhaps, than they should have done.
And did you have, I mean, in your head, were you mentally prepared for it to go beyond 5 years? Or were you like, that I'm not even going to
No.
entertain that. It is 5 years.
I wasn't mentally prepared because I'd only ever been anywhere for 2.5 years. I've been a interim contractor since I was 19. I've never worked permanently for anywhere unless it's been my companies. And so you can deduce from that there's clearly some sort of commitment issue.
I wasn't gonna go into that.
I knew that it, I could probably double the time scale if I was working for myself. It was no more scientific than that. So I hadn't legislated for it being longer than 5 years.
Wow. I mean, I just love the laser focus and foresight and planning around it. I just think it really sets you apart from a lot, most people in and around this sort of concept. I
Yeah,
don't come
I
across many
didn't.
founders that talk that way.
I agree. And I didn't realize how unusual that was until building this business, building up Grafter, because for me, I wouldn't really go into anything without knowing what I was planning on doing with it at some point, or at least thinking what the future holds. And so I find that as alien a concept, I think, as plenty do, my level of planning.
it could be. And so what was the, so you sold the business in 2020, did you say? 2020.
Sold
And
it in
then
2020.
what was the sort of journey from there into the grafter?
So the journey, there was an 18-month period where I had to work for the acquirer, which is quite standard. It felt a little longer than 18 months, if I'm honest, but then most entrepreneurs, we struggle with being managed. I'm no exception. And I guess what happened after that was I originally thought I'm going to take 3 months, 6 months off. I took about 3 months off, and then ended up Well, the Ukraine war had kicked off. We raised a
Oh,
load of
wow.
money. We went in to go and help out over there a couple of times,
Oh,
three
amazing.
entrepreneurs.
Wow.
One of us youthful. One of us actually had clinical experience. The other two of us didn't, but we were useful at raising some money. So we did a couple of trips in over a 12-month period. But I think I also felt a bit lost. My identity was very unclear to me. I actually went and did a psychedelic retreat to have a little look
Okay.
at,
Interesting.
what does the kind of future hold for me? And I've been very open about mental health and
Yeah.
sobriety, as you alluded to. So for me, exploring answers in different ways is not totally
Can
outside
I
the realm of the personality.
just pick that up? Because I'm
Of
sure there
course.
are some people, again, I don't know because I haven't done my research, so maybe I'm wrong, but I'm guessing some people might say that. Or might question the use of psychedelics if you are in recovery. Is that
Yes.
something that people do question? I don't know.
No, it's heavily questioned. And the reason being, you're taking a mind-altering substance. So for me, I debated this myself for probably 12 months, maybe longer, before I made the decision to. And for me, the benefit from a mental health perspective outweighed the risk component. But for anybody listening, the very last thing you would be doing after taking plant medicine is racing back for a rerun, because it has a tendency to be, firstly, it's an inward journey. So you're not at Ministry of Sound having a party. You've
No.
got an eye mask on, you've got headphones on, you're
Well,
in
it's a
a
bit, yeah, it's not the same
semi-clinical
thing, right?
setting. If I think about the psychedelic retreat, there was a number of hours chatting to a psychologist before. It's a very different experience. And so I made the decision that for me, from a sobriety perspective, it wasn't, I didn't feel it was going to reach.
I think that's really interesting because and you know the from the research that I've done into the recovery space, you know, being an outsider looking in, I can well imagine there's a lot of passionate debate about this area, and people will feel very strongly one way or the other, I suspect. But I think it's a really brave and interesting position to take because mental health is obviously really important and really impactful, and if it's if you have poor mental health, that can have all kinds of terrible health outcomes, as can addiction, right? But so and the idea that the maturity of a discussion or a self-discussion around the net benefits versus net risks, I think is really interesting because it you know again I think that a lot of those psychedelics treatments and things like that were on the pathway way back when before the war on drugs into being used to treat mental health issues. So actually, I just think it's a very interesting area. I'm not an expert by any stretch of the imagination. I just think it's interesting.
And I think the other, not wanting to head towards politics at all, but the decision that's been made in the US recently around psychedelics
Which is
for
what are
mental
they?
health. Well, Trump has said, let's go, let's
Has
have a look
he?
at,
I didn't know that.
So let's have a look at both psilocybin and
DMT.
no, not DMT. It's the other one. It's the ibogaine. I don't know how to pronounce that. But both have got proven benefits around addiction and PTSD. And so,
Wow.
I mean, this is in the last week to 10 days.
Is it?
So it's
Wow.
brand new. I don't think it's because I was on a psychedelic retreat recently, Steve, that it's all kicked off. But
I
it's
mean,
just,
partially. I don't want to
it
maybe
should
take some
be.
credit, some not full credit. But so is he, how are they gonna do, are they doing drug trials on it, or how's that, who's paying for that?
They're speeding it up through FDA approval, and they're doing some stuff from looking at veterans, I think, first. But it's that there is just too much evidence now that it is,
Wow.
resetting the neural pathways. And so
You know
the
what? I don't want to get into politics either, However, the US administration, as it currently stands, has done a couple of things, that being one in health, the other being that they just put $50 billion into rural healthcare, hard cash to back rural healthcare that no one's given two F's about. For, you know, so I'm not saying I'm not getting into the wider issues of it, but actually, like, there are some things in there that actually they didn't have to do, and I'm guessing their base probably isn't bothered either way, so they've gone out on a, you know, they've gone out on a limb on both those things.
Well, bearing in mind, I mean, plant medicine and drugs, in my mind, they're different things from a recreational perspective. But Trump has always been very vocal about his view on drugs. I mean, he's sober, he's never
He's
drank, blah, blah,
never
blah.
drunk, never smoked, never, yeah.
And so, but for me, I, you know, and I'm not passing, you know, I'm certainly not wearing a MAGA hat on this discussion here by any stretch of
What?
anyone's
Yeah, you seem like
imagination.
a you seem the stereotypical. What do you mean?
But I agree. I think this move is incredible. So it'd be very interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah, I just think, and at the end of the day, like it or not, what the US does, everyone else tends to follow. So it's a fact. So if this is happening there, and it actually sticks, right, that there isn't some, I don't know what comes out the woodwork later, and some something somewhere, then it all goes off the rails. But if it actually lands and sticks, I don't think Europe's going to be too far behind, because you've got
Well,
places like Portugal, Switzerland that are semi-legalized around some of this stuff. You know, it's also getting harder and harder in the UK, I think, to justify the full situation and position around all drugs and things like that. That's getting tougher and tougher. So anyway, super interesting. Right.
yeah, fascinating.
We will be back after our next commercial break for the final part. And I want to spend the last part just talking about the Grafter. So I think it's an incredible, it's the only organization that I've come across with a laser focus on helping founders build, scale, exit blatantly, openly, clearly. And I think that that's a really interesting proposition. I want to get into it in the last part of the show. So we'll be back in 2 minutes.
The station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Rooster, and my guest this week, Rachel Murphy from The Grafter. So, Rachel, when did you get that moment of inspiration, if there was a moment, around The Grafter? Because you could have done a huge range of different things. Even within the same universe around helping founders, you could have been an advisor on a board, et cetera, et cetera. So why do the Grafter the way that you have done it?
So for me, I didn't want to go and build another company in a sector I knew. I thought that that was going to be too easy. So I think there's something a little masochistic,
Yeah, a
frankly.
little bit, just slightly.
So I when I'd sold Different, I felt that I had an amazing lawyer. I had a father who had sold businesses before. I chose not to have corporate finance, but what I really wanted was somebody who had been there themselves, who understood emotionally and technically what that process felt like, and that it didn't exist. And so for me, I wanted to build something that would help entrepreneurs to understand where they are today, build a roadmap that allows them to have a look at the opportunities and the risks in the business, but then actually have an exiteer, a multi-exited founder who understands their domain and has got the playbook, sit alongside them and help them execute. So that was my motivation. So I built out initially a way of assessing the maturity of a business and tested that with a number of businesses, and then I built grow, raise, exit, which is the methodology by which you take a business from here to here, growing, scaling, raising and exiting. And then I took it out to market, and I wasn't supposed to be launching another business. I wanted to see, can I build a service from scratch and can I get interest in it? I spoke to 42 companies and 21 said, yes, I'll have a bit of that. And then, like all good entrepreneurs.
What does that tell you? What did that tell you about the state of the market in terms of where else people can go for help?
It told me that this service didn't exist, but it also told me that I had a network that I could talk to and ask some of these questions of. Yeah. And I lent in on both of those, I think, to then get the business launched, really, because now the Grafter has 150 entrepreneurs in a community who, you know, we have a WhatsApp group, we meet regularly.
Yeah, super active.
Yeah, lots of sharing, lots of I'm asking for help, all manner of random stuff. But that community has written 2 million of new business so far this year. Nothing to do with us, but through being in that community, they've written that. So for me, I think I knew that community was going to be important for me personally. Mm-hmm. It's like a wider kind of friendship base of people who are building these businesses. But it's also made up with people who want to give more than they take. So the community bit was key. But I think once I had proven that that methodology worked, then I wanted to scale and to go. So now we have 14 Exeteers, 15 very nearly, 14 Exeteers who have built and sold multiple companies in every conceivable sector. And they're all trained on this methodology. You know, we assess businesses on their maturity today. And that's how we operate, what we do.
Give the listeners the three top green flags. So the three like bing, 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 yes, yes, yes. And then the three at the other end where it's like, oh no, oh no, oh no. Like, what are the kind of two, the things you most like to see and the things you that really are a concern if you see them?
The things I most like to see are coachable from a founder and management team. It's absolutely essential. So coachable is key. It helps a lot if revenue is heading in the right direction over the last 3 years. And I think also if they are solving a problem that isn't contained to a certain geographical area, then you know that is tick, tick, tick. The three at the other ends of the spectrum would be, if every decision is running through a founder in a business, that's a huge problem because extracting them out is going to be really hard work. Yeah. If the numbers have been, for whatever reason, tricky over a 3-year period, that just makes our work
just
a little harder. Yeah. And I think the other one for me, probably more a personal one this than necessarily a business one, is about the culture of the business and the founder. So it's, again, it goes a little bit back to the coachable nature, but you know, I've done sales calls before where I've spoken to a founder who, you know, they know it all, they've got all the answers, and you're like, well, what are you on the phone to me for then? And it's not, you know, there's not an arrogance. It's just that if you've got it all sorted, what are you doing here?
And how do they respond to that sometimes?
depends how frank I am, actually. So I think there's a nervousness on asking for help. I think that there's a bit of a shame that people need it. And I think there's also, am I going to be, you know, sharing this and my competition are going to find out and know. And so, you know, it depends a lot on what the drivers are around that as to how we handle it. But the reality for me is if I look at our most successful kind of engagements, then it's the more open, the better. keen to learn and put a shift in. You know, this isn't, we can do a lot of things, but we can't do the founder's
Well,
job for them.
I mean, look, if you like selling your business is a whole, it's a whole team, it's a full court press. You know, it's that, like, if that's your goal, then that's an enormous lifetime achievement. So the amount of energy associated, it should be sort of proportional, commensurate to that. I mean, to your point around demand, and I think one of the things around those founder interactions, you know, as I speak as a founder, you know, is around that vulnerability. So I think that, you know, one of the things that I do is nowhere near the scale that you've done it, but the last Friday of every month, I give up my time to do this thing I've called the Last Friday Club, where people can book in and I can just help them with their challenges. And the reason I did it was I realized that there wasn't anywhere where you could have a chat with somebody without there being some sort of an agenda. You know, you have to pay an advisor, you can't, the board has your investors on it, etc., and so on and so forth. And the amount of demand I got for that is insane. I mean, it's crazy. Like, I wish I could make a business out of that, but unfortunately, giving my time away for free isn't really such a great business. But I completely understand that nervousness, and it kind of traps you into trying to make it out like everything's great. And it's like, well, why are we? If everything's great, then what? You know, what's going on?
And I think that's the bit. And the reality is, if I look at we've worked with 60 companies since the Grafter started, and you know, 10% of them have wanted to exit. You know, there's a lot of the work that we do, which is around how do we grow the revenue? How do we look at initiatives like acquisition as a growth strategy, which is something that only private equity firms would have been doing, you know, less than 5 years ago. And the reality is, you know, these tools, techniques, methodologies are available to all founders. And sometimes we just need a helping hand along the way to make that a reality.
Yeah. And I feel like it's such a good community, and I think community is so important. And one of the things that I've noticed, I didn't have a healthcare background before starting at PopDoc. One of the things that I've really noticed in health in the UK is that it's very insular, and people are unwilling or lack any much interest in looking at examples from outside of health, sometimes not even outside of UK health, in terms of peer comparisons or inspiration or anything like that. And I think that makes it very, very, very myopic. And it's very easy to get sort of trapped into this sort of, you know, slightly negative frame of mind where, you know, bad headlines around the NHS mean the sky's falling in, which it doesn't at all, actually. And so, you know, I love telling this story. So I'm on the NHS SME advisory board, and it contains SMEs that sell into the NHS across anything, right? So that, you know, the people that sell in bog roll to people doing innovative cholesterol screening like us, everybody. And so the reason I wanted to join it was because I wanted to get exposure to businesses that have been unbelievably successful about working with the NHS in any vertical. So one of the
guys, that's a good way of doing it.
Yeah. So, but, and I don't understand why, in just because businesses are tagged as innovative, it means that we are only able to interact with other innovative businesses. So one of the other guys on this board, called Danny, he runs all milk supply. He's the largest independent supplier of milk in the southwest to NHS hospitals. He's like the king of milk.
Yeah.
Like, he supplies 6,000 liters a week, and you're like, that's amazing. Why don't we learn what Danny did and then bring it back over here? You know, I don't know whether you feel the same way about anything tagged as innovative. Is sometimes it's got benefits to it, but it also seems to have a bit of there's some downsides, becomes quite narrow.
Well, I think that narrow bit, I think the learning across sectors for me and different geographies is incredible. You know, when we first started out Grafter, the first probably 50 clients were 100% UK based. The last 10 have been the US, Australia, South Africa. And so I think the learning of different geographical locations, but for me, I love learning how different businesses are handling some of the challenges we're all having. You know, I had some of the best conversations with a lad that owns a builder's merchant around how he was doing digital marketing. Not that my ICP are going to be hanging out in the same space, but that sharing and learning, and I think not being precious about it. For me, you know, I love learning and I don't care where it comes from, providing I feel that I'm sort of topping up. But yeah, I think there's huge amounts of benefit in that. Everywhere.
So this last couple of minutes of the show, and I ask my every single guest, I ask this, which is, in your career, as you've gone through quite eloquently, there's been some really difficult moments, and in life as well. You know, you've been on a recovery journey for 12 years. What kind of self-talk or what kind of mantras or mottos or phrases do you return to that help you get through difficult times that you want to share with the listeners that might help them?
So I guess my mantra and phrase growing up would have been you only live once. And that therefore meant that there was probably many misspent adventures on a night out. And I think over the years that has probably changed a little. Or the sentiment remains the same, but I'm going after different things. So for me, I think we live in a fascinating world at the minute, a crazy one, but fascinating. The ability to build businesses, make a difference, make something happen. I'm not sure that that has ever been as fast as it is right now. So for me, I guess it's about taking action. It's not, you know, doing the same thing day in, day out and hoping, you know, for a different result. It's like, get on, take some risks, make some moves, have some fun, and get out there and do it.
Brilliant. Well, look, on that note, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on. If people want to know about The Grafter, where do they go?
TheGrafter.com.
TheGrafter.com. Thank you so much to everyone listening. We'll be back again next week with a new show. Thank you.